Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the Campbell Creek Science Center, where Richard Nelson, host and producer of Encounters at Raven Radio in Sitka, Alaska, is giving a talk entitled Listening to Alaska. Recorded on May 14th, Richard Nelson was hosted by KSKA in partnership with the Bureau of Land Management.
Well, welcome everyone to the Campbell Creek Science Center. My name is Jeff Bruni. I'm the manager here. I work for the Bureau of Land Management. Wow, what a turnout. This is great. Who here listens to KSKA radio? Holy smokes. Well, we are so excited to be here tonight. Before we get started, I want to mention that this is a partnership with the Alaska Public Telecommunications, Inc. and the Bureau of Land Management. We are very, very excited to partner for this event. Now I'd like to introduce Steve Lindbeck. He's the president and general manager of the Alaska Public Telecommunications, Inc., and he will be introducing our guest speaker tonight. Steve?
Thank you, Jeff. Okay, what a treat. It turns out, I just heard a report there's about 100 people out in the parking lot that couldn't get in. You guys beat them to it, so there you are. And it's really a great pleasure. Thank you all for coming, and thank you, Jeff. You and your team have done a great job. We appreciate this partnership. This is the kind of thing we love to do in our community, to put together events like this and use the sort of fame and opportunity of our wonderful speaker and people like him on public broadcasting to kind of help tell the stories. So it's a real pleasure to see you all here tonight and to also say thank you. I saw all those hands that went up when Jeff asked about the listening on KSKA. And the reason I'm saying thank you is we recently just got our Arbitron ratings, and KSKA is the top of the heap in radio stations in Anchorage. We like it, too. And one of the reasons that it's doing this well is with us tonight, Richard Nelson and his program, Encounters. Many of you, I think, have heard Richard speak in the past. I hope you've all heard him on KSKA or another of the public radio stations that he appears on. And he is a very well-known speaker and writer and raconteur around Alaska. He transports us out into the woods, sometimes into urban woods, and he may be talking about that a little bit tonight. Some of his credits, I think, people who've lived around Alaska over the last literally 50 years would have been able to encounter Richard and his work. He first came to Alaska at age 19. He lived in Kodiak way back in 1961, and in the Aleutians and in Wainwright. He spent some time in the Koyukon Athabascan region. And he now lives in Sitka, and I'm probably missing a few steps along the way that I hope he'll share with us. His books are well known across the state, and they include Hunters of the Northern Ice, Make Prayers to the Raven, which became a PBS television series, Shadow of the Hunter, Heart and Blood, Living with Deer in America, The Island Within, and a book that he co-authored with some of our other favorite nature writers in this country, Barry Lopez and Terry Tempest Williams. That book was called Patriotism and the American Land. So without any further introduction, let me introduce a great pleasure to have him here today with us, Richard Nelson.
Thanks, Steve, and thanks to the Campbell Creek Center, and my gosh, thanks to all of you for coming. Gee, it's wonderful to see you, and it's great to see so many people coming to a place like this.
Don't tell the fire marshal.
Yeah, we won't. Our lips are sealed. I also want to really thank the folks from KSKA who made this happen, especially Cindy, wherever Cindy is. Cindy Stofflett, she's the one who put in a lot of hours for this, and Also, as always, I want to acknowledge my very, very profound debt to the Alaskan Native teachers and guides who have been so patient with me over the years and who have showed me, or tried to show me anyway, so many things about the world and about their world and how they live in it. Okay, now here's the deal. I'm just hoping this we don't descend into complete chaos. I was saying to Steve earlier that so many of the things that have happened in my life have been totally accidental. Coming to Alaska was an accident, and becoming a writer was certainly a total accident, and getting into radio was another accident, and particularly the radio thing, because I do not have a good relationship with technology. It's a very troubled one. And at the radio station in Sitka, they were kind of at the point where they just didn't want me coming in there, because everything I touched seemed to crumble into disrepair. So what I'm going to try to do is play some sounds, and just within the last few minutes, kind of worked out how to do this. I'm the sort of a person who really likes to be prepared, and this is a notable exception. But what I want to do is, by the way, I don't know if you can see them, but I didn't want you to miss my new shoes. Like those babies? You know, there's some things in life you can feel proud of, and I think that might be one of them. I'm not sure. All right, here's the deal. I'm going to play some little sounds for you. And I know there's some biologists that snuck in here. I see them. They're old friends. And so maybe they'll hold back a little bit. I also want to say a special hello to my pen pal, Puck, right here. We've been exchanging letters for a long time, and Puck sends me drawings and letters that are pinned up on my walls, and it's just I've never met him before, so this is a big pleasure for me right here. I've been waiting to meet Puck for a long time. All right, so here's the thing. I'm going to play a couple of sounds, just a couple of them, and just to see, you know, kind of test you for your knowledge of natural history. And this is also a little test of our. I think we might need. We definitely need volume. All right, ready? Now listen. Couple more. Here comes another one. Wow, who said that? Say it again.
Muskox.
Wow. Now, I mean, if you start out at that age, where are you going to get to? Wow, that's great. Thanks. All right. Let's try another one. A lot of people are going to know this one. I can't believe I'm actually doing this, getting these on the screen. This is a serious miracle. Okay, here we go. Listen closely. Keep listening. This is ocean. Well, it's in a way. There was your big hint, huh?
Sandpiper.
Wow, see, you knew there was going to be a bird geek in here. All right, here it is. This is your answer. Right there. Shorebirds. These are These are the shorebirds in Cordova, just a little bit earlier than now. I want you to hear this part again. Listen to this. Imagine how many birds this is. All right. It does sound like a whale. It sounds like the ocean. It's bird wings. It's huge numbers of bird wings. Thousands and thousands of bird wings. All right, let's give you the easiest Alaskan sound that it's possible to give you. All right. Here it is. Now listen closely, because there's more than just voice in here.
Raven.
I mean, you'd come all the way to Alaska just to hear that, wouldn't you? Oh, my God. I recorded this. These ravens, it was a mob of them, and they were circling around over my head. And I recorded them over a moose carcass just outside Glacier Bay in Gustavus. And it was a hunter-killed moose carcass. Had been visited by brown bears or black bears, maybe had been visited by wolves. And these ravens just kept circling over my head. And I wanted to play a little clip of ravens right at the beginning, because as you know, in many of the indigenous communities in Alaska, it's the raven who created the world. And several of the most important years of my life were spent as an apprentice to Koyukon Indian people in the villages of Huslia and Hughes and Alakakit on the Kayakuk River. And from them, I learned a little bit about the traditions, the spiritual traditions, and the ideas of how the world came to be and how people should live in it. And in their tradition, the raven, the great raven, the raven that created the world is called Dotsontsa. And he created the world one way, and that didn't seem right to him. Like the rivers flowed two directions. What we think of as upstream on one side and downstream on the other side. And Raven figured that's way too easy. So Raven recreated the thing so they only flowed one direction. I mean, you know. So in the Koyukon traditional way of seeing it, if I understand correctly, when a person looks at a raven flying overhead, you're, in a sense, looking directly into the eyes of the Creator. You're looking into the eyes of God. Now, I don't know. I don't really understand this at all, but that's the words I would put it in. And people also talk to ravens, ask ravens for help, for protection, and they thank the raven for things. And I wanted to hear the raven's voice at the beginning to start by thanking whoever it was for all the glory and beauty and richness of Alaska. Well, since I was a really little kid, like kindergarten age, like probably younger than some of our friends here, I was always chasing butterflies around the backyard. I was always fascinated for some reason with nature. How that happened in the middle of Madison, Wisconsin, I honestly can't tell you. It was just there. And from that, as I got into like junior high school, that transmogrified into an obsession, and I use that word advisedly, with reptiles. My mother was crazy about this. She, of all the things in the world she didn't want to have around her house, it would have been snakes particularly. And that's what I had the most of. So I have to thank her for indulging this peculiar fascination. Well, unfortunately for the budding herpetologist, I got distracted to Alaska when I was, the summer after my freshman year at the University of Wisconsin, I had an opportunity to come to Alaska, to Kodiak Island. This was in 1961, and if you can calculate that quickly, you'll come up with my age and tell me if you figure it out, because I can never, I either can't or don't want to remember. So I got this amazing job to be an assistant for a field biology project in the, over near the village of Old Harbor, if you know Kodiak Island. So in the wilds of Kodiak, totally by accident, started to get acquainted with this incredible place that has taken complete possession of me. Then in 1963, I got to go along on another incredible accidental thing as a trowel hand for an archaeological dig in on a little island about halfway out the Aleutian Chain. Spent a summer on that island that was inhabited mostly by amazing birds like whiskered auklets, for all you twitchers. Aussies call bird watchers twitchers. I love that word. I wouldn't say it if I wasn't a twitcher myself. And then I switched from a biology major, having recognized I had absolutely no talent for that. It involved numbers and chemistry and IQ things. Switched into anthropology, which was, I don't know, what did I just say about anthropology? Sorry. It used a different part of the brain, let's put it that way. And switched into anthropology, cultural anthropology. And I did that because I had been reading these ethnographies in my anthropology classes and saw that the kind of natural history that fascinated me wasn't taught in biology classes at that time. You can take natural history classes now. Then natural history was old-fashioned. Where the kind of knowledge that sort of took hold of me was being taught was in native communities. And so I switched into anthropology, the study of humans, paradoxically, in order to learn about nature. And that was one heck of a good decision, accidental decision, but a good one. Starting at when I was 23 years old, I had a chance to go live for a year in the village of Wainwright, up on the North Slope, the next village down the coast from Barrow. I spent a year there, the most amazing job next to the one I have now, to learn how to subsist and survive on the sea ice with a grant from the U.S. Air Force. Think about this. The U.S. Air Force, somebody in the U.S. Air Force, an anthropologist by the name of Frederick Milan, who lived for many years in Fairbanks, the insight to know that if you wanted to know how to stay alive on the sea ice, you went to the people who knew the most about it, the native people. And so I was to gather information to be used by pilots who would happen to crash on the Arctic ice. I think the fact that that job existed at all is much more significant than the fact that I was the person who got to do it. Because after 400 years of completely ignoring this vast encyclopedic knowledge that indigenous people have on this continent, somebody finally got around to sending out someone to ask a few questions and try to learn something. Luckily, that's still going on, and I think, especially here in Alaska. So I lived with Inupiaq people in Wainwright, then spent a year with Gwich'in people in Chalkeetsuk up by Fort Yukon, and then several years with Koyukon people in those villages along the Koyukuk River. And my job all that time was to record the way people do their subsistence and what they know about and believe about the natural world. I am incredibly grateful for those opportunities to learn about the northern environment and natural history from people who know it most intimately, and grateful for the chances that I had through that work, if you want to call it that, to saturate myself in some of Alaska's wildest places. And I use that word wildest advisedly, always remembering that people have lived there for many, many thousands of years. It's not that people have been there, but the way that they have lived that's important, because that's why Alaska is what it is today. So anyway, that led to eventually, this is the end of the biography part, to settling down in Southeast Alaska and following a life that centers a lot around subsistence and being outdoors as much as possible. Part of the work that I did with indigenous people in Alaska ended up in writing, and writing books as an effort to pass along what the people had so generously passed on to me in the villages. Eventually, I kind of went from writing ethnography to writing creative nonfiction, kind of nature writing or place writing, I prefer to think of it. But I did that for some years, and then I finally realized, hang on, there's a problem here. I'm sitting here, anchored inside the house, writing about where I want to be. And so I decided it was time to give up writing until I'm too old or addled to do the things I love most. And so I thought, what can I do next? And I had gotten interested in documentary film and especially radio. Another one of those accidents. I thought, if you use that kind of media, you can probably pass along this knowledge and experience to a lot more people and to maybe a greater diversity of people. So that was a fortuitous kind of side spin of a change that I decided to make. Bring people into the natural world this way and increase their awareness of native traditions. So there was a guy, there is a guy named Ken Fate, who was at that time the program director at the public radio station that we call Raven Radio in Sitka, where I live. And Ken came to me one day and said, how would you like to take over Fin and Feather? Fin and Feather was an interview program about the outdoors. And a guy named Eric Jordan had invented this, fisherman guy had invented this program. And I said, yeah, okay, it's time to do this. And so I started interviewing people. Whenever I talk to somebody, it seems I'm always interviewing, but it turned out I really wasn't a terribly good interviewer. So I took over this program, doing interviews. I did that for a few months, but two things. One, as I said, I wasn't a particularly good interviewer guy, and I was very shy. I always felt like I was imposing on people. To ask him, oh, can you come in and do this interview? And it made me feel terrible about myself. And I shouldn't say this. I'm here talking. This is a radio thing here. They interview people on KSK all the time. But anyway, that was my own personal psychodrama there. And another thing that I felt that I wasn't skilled enough to fully bring out what those people I was interviewing had to say. So I got this idea. I thought, what if I would research a subject, go somewhere where the subject happened to be, and interview myself? I am telling you, that is absolutely... I'm Norwegian from the Midwest. There's nothing subtle, complex. I thought, I will interview myself. I have sort of total control over the situation. I don't have to ask anybody. I know I want to do it. So I had met this really... the trigger point was I met this really fascinating bunch of people. Do those windows open over there? And would you guys mind opening them? Hi, everybody out there. I'm sorry. It's pretty warm in here. You're lucky to be out there, really.
Richard, this is what they call standing room only outside.
Plus, you know what else? You guys can leave if it gets boring. Think of these poor people in here. They're doomed. Okay, so, where was I? Oh, I met these fascinating elder people in Tasmania. In fact, one old gentleman who told me that when he was growing up, he could hear this amazing animal that's called the thylacine or the Tasmanian tiger. You almost would have had to be in Tasmania to know about it. It's a marsupial, absolutely a mirror image of a wolf or a coyote. But it's a marsupial, it's a pouched animal. If you don't know about this animal, the thylacine, and you want to know how powerful and amazing evolution, or whatever you want to call it, is, learn about the thylacine. It's extinct, killed off by the early European settlers in Tasmania. Anyway, this man had heard these animals as a young man. The last one known to have been alive was in the Hobart, Tasmania Zoo in 1936. Oh, I wanted to interview these people, especially that man. And they said, oh, no, verifying all my worst fears, we're way too shy for that. So I thought, that does it. I went on top of a mountain in northern Tasmania, looking out over this sprawl of beautiful landscape, and I interviewed myself about Tasmania. I did go on the radio, but I think only in Sitka. So that's what I did, and eventually, Ken Fate right away told me, hey, I like the thing you're doing way better than I like your interviews. So that's how Encounters came to be as it is now. Instead of doing it as a volunteer at the radio station, we started getting some grants to support it, and it became my full-time job. And now we're lucky enough to have other reporters doing Encounters programs. Maybe you've heard Elizabeth Arnold, who you know from NPR, is recording Encounters programs. So is Jeb Sharp, who is with The World in Boston. And my boss, really, Lisa Bush, who is in charge of Encounters, also produces some stories. She's got one coming up on solitude, wilderness, and stuff. Was it already on the radio? Yeah. I haven't heard it yet. I want to hear it. I never hear the program. I can't remember when it's on. That's the other process, the gradual, you know, the neurons, just, I don't know where they go. Anyway, so the programs are half an hour long, and the ones I do feature, just sort of feature one voice, and that really is against the rules in radio, I'm told. It's always about nature and the environment, and it's aired on public stations around Alaska and on stations various parts of the United States and Canada. Had one program about polar bears on the radio in Australia, which was pretty cool. The Encounters programs that I produce are done by, I only found this out when I started doing it. Ken told me that you're doing live to tape. I didn't know what that meant. I told him, I don't want to have to be at the radio station on Saturday. What if the surf's up? So I started recording these interviews and then, of course, recording the programs. They're always done live to tape, they're always done in the field, and they're always done as close as possible or reasonable as or somewhat responsible to the subject. Wide range of topics, from polar bears to red squirrels, from moose in Anchorage to polar bears on the Arctic coast, and stuff like salmon and bird songs and cold and puffins and all kinds of topics, whatever I think of that would be fun. Those programs, I really can't emphasize this enough. Encounters programs are strictly 100% nonfiction. I've never written fiction, and I don't do fiction on the radio either. Because a lot of people ask me, are those really recorded out there, or are you doing it in a studio and putting in the sounds? No. They are recorded exactly where I say they're being recorded. I travel to wherever the place is, usually camping, unless it's near my home in southeast Alaska. Find the subject. That can sometimes mean a long wait. In fact, I waited 3 years for the killer whales to swim past my house with the notes always ready to go. I've been waiting 5 years for the program on the black-footed albatross, and I am determined that I'm going to do it this summer. I've been way out there in the ocean on my skiff trying to chum them in with salmon guts and all. They don't want to be on the radio. And then when the moment comes, I turn on the recorder and start to talk. And in the beginning, I would talk for 28 and a half minutes and shut off the recorder. I mean, I don't want you to ever hear any of those. Now I'll usually record the program for anywhere from 45 minutes to, I start getting really, really twitchy when it's close to an hour, and I think, oh my God. And then I go back to the studio, which is really a little room off my kitchen, and sit at the computer and edit out, you know, just the way you would if you took a lot of pictures and you wanted the ones you like best. edit out the stumbles and the stupidity. And a lot of times I'll say something one way and think, oh, no, no, I think I can say that a better way, and I'll say it. Oftentimes it's not a better way. cut them down to 28 minutes. Now, in a few minutes, give you an idea of the equipment that I use. I want to try, here we go again. Equipment Dolt is going to try to play something for you. And part of it is like, it's, you know how it gets where you can't see the way you used to be able to? Hate to admit that. All right, this is a bunch of excerpts from Encounters programs that Ken Fate put together. Here we go. That's a penguin sneaker there. Ken didn't know it was a penguin. Didgeridoo. I play didgeridoo.
Hi, I'm Richard Nelson for Encounters, a program of observations, experiences, and reflections on the world around us.
This is the ultimate sound of wildness. I'm on a hillside overlooking the broad, braided, gravelly reaches of the Toklat River in the center of Denali National Park in interior Alaska.
I've got sea lions porpoising and slashing back and forth in the water about 30 feet up. Oh, 20 feet, correction. 5 feet, correction. One just sort of swirled the water right smack in front of my kayak. You can hear me paddling. I'm paddling backwards. And now I'm going to change my population estimate. Maybe 60 or so sea lions, all heads stretched up 2 or 3 feet in the air.
That moose is running straight toward me. It's gotten wind of the grizzly bear. And holy mackerel, life is exciting. I'm just going to stand up here right in the open so that if the moose comes up on top of this ridge, it's going to see that I'm a person and not a bear.
Some examples of Inupiaq Eskimo words for snow. Apun is the general word for snow. Kanik is the word for a snowflake, like the kinds that are accumulating on my jacket sleeves and my glove.
Creeping very slowly. Oh, yeah, there they are. Ooh, I'm really close to them now. I'm moving very, very, very carefully forward. And I have only a rock to block me. I don't know if you can hear the wind whistling. Oh, one big mountain sheep appears to have caught sight of me, a magnificent ram, pure white as snow. He walks up onto a little rocky prominence, leaps to another rocky prominence, absolutely graceful.
These salmon are fertilizing the forest itself. They are nutrients brought from the far reaches of the Pacific Ocean into this forest. And the nitrogen and other nutrients of these fish accumulating have a very important effect of helping to nourish the forest itself. And it begins to add up over the course of millennia to something very important. Streams are like arteries and veins running from the sea into the body of the land and the forest. So here is a beautiful reciprocity between fish and land.
Listening to the Swainson's thrush like this, I can't help marveling that such beauty as this has arisen out of the natural world, as if bird songs existed purely to elevate the human spirit or the human soul. But of course, scientists have another view. They suggest that females may be attracted to males with the greatest, most complex vocal repertoire. So we may have evolution to thank for this beautiful voice of the summer. Still, I can't help thinking that a female Swainson's thrush believes in beauty just as much as I do.
Hey,
it seems that perhaps we all have something to learn from people like the Koyukon Indians, people who have lived entirely by hunting and fishing and gathering for millennia, who have shared the land with wolves but have never tried to eliminate them.
I remember being in a boat going down a stream in southeast Alaska with my Koyukon teacher, Catherine Atla, when she noticed that there was a brown bear on the shore. This was during the time of the salmon. And she didn't look at it. She didn't speak directly of it, but obliquely said, look over that way. And it was hard for us to know where she meant because she wouldn't look in the direction. Because for her, as a Koyukon woman, it was inappropriate to speak of the bear or even to look at it because of its power and the way that bear power interacts with women's power. I'm hesitating because the bear is walking toward me, now stops, turns back. When it breathes, I can see it, that I can hear the huffing of its breath and see the little cloud of fog blowing out over the sand. Being out in this deep winter cold reminds me that there's beauty and fascination in every cranny of our world. It reminds me that all nature is the community to which we ourselves belong. And it reminds me also that our voices are the earth singing to itself. For Encounters on a Beautiful Cold Winter Day, I'm Richard Nelson. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time. Well, thank you. Thanks so much. I haven't listened to that for a long time, and it's pretty cool for me because every one of those, you know, brings a really vivid memory of the situation at the time. And that last little part about the brown bear was the first Encounters program I ever made in Alaska, and it was right by my house. This bear was feeding on the carcass of a Cuvier's beaked whale that had washed up on this beach, a pretty exotic whale. And it hung around there for a couple of weeks, and I hung around it a lot, and it was completely accustomed to me being there. There was nothing between us taller than a rock about that big, but it wasn't interested in me, most of the time anyway. I can't remember if there was something else I was going to comment on there, but maybe not. So to say a few things about Encounters before moving on to talk more about sounds, the goals that I have in mind for Encounters are the same that I always had in mind for my work as a writer. I always said I'm not interested in any work that doesn't have to do with either the protection of the environment or helping people to understand and respect indigenous cultures in Alaska. Other than that, there isn't enough time in one life, my one life, to do anything else. So for Encounters, I think of it as, first of all, to try to educate people about the natural world, about science, about traditional indigenous knowledge, about human relationships to the environment. I also think of it equally as a celebration of the beauty and the richness and the mystery of the wild environment and of the wisdom and importance of native traditions. And also for me, it's a program of advocacy. I'm very much an activist when it comes to the environment, but I save my overt, explicit, outspoken advocacy for another venue. And Encounters I see as a way of advocating mainly by showing people there's a reason to care about wild nature and about the need to respect native traditions. So I don't want to marginalize Encounters as a greenie type program, although I'm green to the gills. But it's also just not my personal style. There are some big personal rewards in doing this project. I am very, very hungry for scientific knowledge of the natural world, and I have absolute, utmost, highest respect
for scientists who are out there helping us all to understand more about the world we live in. I believe that science has never, ever been so important to us as it is right now. And we should never let anyone for a second disrespect science in the name of politics. And there are some people... You are clapping for some people in this room. You may or may not know who they are. It's not me. I do it also because I want to experience the wildest places I can possibly get to. I spent a lot of time in very wild places when I was in my early 20s and early 30s. And now that I'm nudging the latter part of the 60s, I want to get back to those wildest places where I've ever been. So I've been spending a lot of time in places like the Brooks Range. I do it also because I love to do creative work with words, with language, and I have become completely enraptured with sounds, and we'll talk about that a little bit more soon. I also do it because I believe in service to the subject, to give something back in return for all the gifts that come from the land and from indigenous teachers. I call this job plerk, meaning it's a wonderful combination of play and work. All right, I want to play a little excerpt for you. Another, just one other little thing that shows more the indigenous side of encounters. If you didn't ever hear this program, it's a program about wind, and I recorded, Sitka's a pretty stormy place sometimes, and I recorded it during the biggest storm we had during the fall of this year, and I recorded it as I had learned from John Muir by climbing as high as I could in a tree, and it scared the living daylights out of me. It was absolutely the scariest piece of recording I ever did. Okay, so here it is.
In the Arctic, brawny storms blow freely across those vast open swaths of sea ice and tundra. Not surprisingly, Inupiaq people who live up on the North Slope of Alaska know a lot about wind. It's crucial to their survival to know about wind, where they have frigid, blinding blizzards so commonly. Here's a few Inupiaq Eskimo wind terms. Ikugnuk means north wind. Kiluagnuk, east wind. Ungalak, south wind. Kanugnuk, west wind. Nigekpuk, northeast wind. That tends to be a very powerful one up there on the slope. The Inupiaq people have a bunch of very clever strategies for dealing with wind. One of the more important ones is that when you're leaving the village, it's a good idea to go out against the wind, because that way when you come home, you can have the wind at your back. That's one that's really worth remembering. There are also lots of ways of navigating by the snowdrifts that are shaped by the wind. Different kinds of snowdrifts shaped by the northeast wind as compared to the southwest wind. And so it's a very handy little compass that is laid out across the snow-covered land in the winter. It's important, too, to recognize that you don't want to wander around in a blizzard. If you get lost, the best thing for you to do is to make yourself a shelter, a snow block wall or a snow house, or put up a tent and wait until the storm subsides rather than roaming around out there and getting cold and getting yourself more lost. So there are lots of interesting ways that Inupiaq people know to predict wind. For example, the sled dogs, if they're howling a lot on a winter night and stars are twinkling like crazy, that's a sign that there's going to be a wind. And say you go out on the sea ice to hunt the next morning after all that's been going on the night before, and you notice that the current is flowing strongly from the south, and perhaps even notice that the seals are behaving in a kind of a furtive way. They don't just come up to the surface and lounge around and hang out there. Rather than that, they just kind of stick their head up and pull it back down again. Those are also storm signs.
So, the weird thing about that is I sound so calm in it. You know, I haven't listened to it for a long time. I'm clinging to a branch up there, and there's this roaring wind, and the thing is flailing back and forth. Well, I'm no John Muir, but it was a pretty amazing experience, and I can imagine there where somebody would have recorded that in the studio. I didn't realize it was going to sound like that. Anyway, recording these radio programs over the past 5 or 6 or 7 years or 8 or whatever it's been, another aspect of it is that it has tremendously increased my awareness of natural sounds. I loved, that's not past tense, I love recording these sounds purely for themselves. It's given me a fully, much more fuller appreciation for the beauty and the richness of sounds around us. I enjoy the challenges of being with an animal for long periods of time and trying to get close as I possibly can to it. It's very much like hunting. You completely lose awareness of time, and you have this exquisite kind of focus on something. It's the closest I ever get to meditating, but I really do think of it as that kind of a thing. And of course, when you're unlike the other kind of hunting that I do a lot, the success in recording brings food for your soul rather than for your body. Now, a neat thing about radio is that the equipment that you carry is so small and lightweight. I travel around with a videographer named Daniel Zatz, who some of you may know. He's a really, really fine nature photographer, lives in Homer. And when he goes out, he carries 700, 800, 1,000 pounds of gear. He's got one camera now that weighs more than any of us do. And I like that very much about radio, that the equipment is so light. This is what I use. I don't know if I mentioned it here, that one of the things I'm hoping to do while I'm here in Anchorage after a week or so from now is record a radio program about urban wildlife here. And this is the equipment that I'll use to do that. Here's the little headphones. It's a little bit tangled. There, you can see it. I try to have it a little neater than this when I'm working. So there's the brand new headphones. Those are not very expensive. I think they're brand new. I haven't used them yet. They're about $100 for those. This is a backup recorder. I have a very fancy recorder, but it's at the repair shop. I'm not known for treating equipment really well. And I mean, when you think of what you're doing, you know, you have this extremely delicate, it's basically a computer. So I'm using this backup recorder. The normal one is about three or four times this size. And this is, I guess, in some ways you would say it's expensive. It's about $600. It's brand new. I also have never used it. I use this to capture the natural sounds. I can't do both at the same time. I can't talk. So I record the sounds of the place and time right there and use those sounds, but I have to do that separately. And this thing will really pick up sounds. It's like a telephoto lens on a camera, parabolic dish. And it's really cool because it rolls up, so it's real portable. That's kind of an expensive outfit there. That's about $1,000 with the microphone, maybe more than that. And then to record the actual narration, I use this little microphone that hooks on here. It's under the headphones. Okay, and so that's it. That's the whole deal. And then at home, my computer, all the sounds, like this laptop right here has all the sounds that I've recorded for years. It's just right here. And I don't know that I want to pick it up and show it to you, but if you want to come later, you can see what it looks like on the screen. So that's what it involves. A great thing about doing this with this small amount of equipment is you can work alone, and I usually do. That's what you want to be when you're trying to be close to animals and stuff like that. And also, it allows, I'm able to be totally focused and immersed in the quiet and beauty and peace of these wild places. Now, let me play a few more sounds for you. I'm conscious that it's getting a little bit, time is going by here. Now, this one, you're going to have to really listen. You may want to crank up the audio. You're going to really have to listen. I challenge somebody to identify this one until it gets about 25 seconds in. Listen closely. Keep listening. Very thrush. Keep listening. A little bit hard to hear. It's actually an eagle. Some good people nailed that immediately. Can you guess what that eagle just did? Whoa! Wait a minute. How did it do it? Keep working on that one. With its claws. This happened last time. That's really good. That is really good. A lot of A pluses in this room, front of the room. That's why they're in front. I was recording thrushes last summer for a program about thrushes. And it was on a trail not far from my home in Sitka. And this bald eagle did this numerous times. It would fly out. You can hear the wings. And there were tall snags with dead tops. And it would fly out and it would grab dry branches and snap them off. And then you could hear it go back to the nest. It obligingly identified itself right when it landed at the nest and then worked the stick into the nest. I don't know. I was just completely beside myself. I'd never seen it. And I had my recorder on, you know, and I thought, oh, my God, how often does that happen when something really awesome happens and the recorder's on? I'll give you a kind of a 1 foot putt here. All right. This one, again, audio is going to have to be cranked up. It's short.
Beaver.
Guys, we're going to have to work here. Yeah. That was a beaver just outside Fairbanks chewing. It's too soft to play it again. Anyway, chewing and then realizing that it had company. Now, here's one. So sometimes this thing is very quiet and subtle like that, and then sometimes not nearly so quiet and relaxed. Let me get this one for you, and I think some people will know what this is. The whale part is right. Humpback whales. One more. Doing a kind of that sort of hissing blow that they do oftentimes when they're not exactly relaxed, I guess. That's what my whale biologist friend Jan Straley believes anyway. I was about 30 miles out on the ocean from my house in my 19-foot skiff. I was completely alone. I couldn't even see another boat. Luckily, it was glassy, calm ocean. I was chasing albatrosses unsuccessfully. And along came this group of whales and passed on either side of the boat, 10 feet away, and I'm just like this, you know, just trying to control all body functions. I thought I should start the engine. This is starting to feel kind of dicey because I've already had collision issues with whales in my skiff. Okay. Oh, I think I did find this one at the last minute. I love this particular recording. I'm going to tell you what it is. I was recording a radio program about brown bears and just outside the boundary of Katmai National Park. And there were about 10 or 12 brown bears around a pond that had a lot of salmon in them. And there was one bear that every time one of the bears caught a salmon, this bear, a female with two cubs, would chase it, argue with it, steal the salmon, and back. And what you'll hear well out on the tide flats, on the north side of Cook Inlet, is one of these encounters between the bears. The chase, right past me, the argument. Argument settled, running back past me again, waiting for the next one. It's a little hard to hear some of that detail of these sounds here. I need to find one other sound that I really want you to hear. And I wasn't quick enough to find it while we were getting ready. Let me just see if I've got it. Yes. Okay. Somebody in this room is going to know what this is. Somebody guess puffin. They don't sound like that. Okay. All right, who's got it? Come on, there's a twitcher in here. Pardon? Not an oyster catcher. We're lukewarm. Think tube nose. Tube nose. Who'd guess, Petrol? Yeah. It's, I never can remember. I believe it's a fork-tailed storm petrel. The leeches is the one that has the raspy call. Oh, I'm a bad twitcher. Anyway, this is on St. Lazaria Island, National Wild, part of the big Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, one of the greatest kinds of wildland preserves anywhere on Earth. And these are storm petrels. About 500,000 of them come in at night, and you got this sound just roaring in your ears. That's putting the microphone down in the burrow where the bird is. Okay, we got to get going here. Time's wasting. I'm only a quarter of the way through, but don't worry. So I got really interested in recording natural sounds, and I've recorded thousands and thousands and thousands of tracks. I spent part of the last few summers up in the gates of the Arctic National Park in the Brooks Range recording for an archive of natural sounds for the park. And apart from being really serious major fun, it's the kind of sounds that can be used for training bird researchers. It is being used for that. The Park Service is also very much interested nationwide in recording, doing natural sounds work in the parks to record, to get an idea of how much intrusive natural sound, human sound there is in these protected places. And as you know, in some parks there is quite a lot. Also, it's a way to document changes in the sound environment in places like national parks, maybe because of ecological succession. If you picked a given spot in Glacier National Park and began recording sounds there, you would find over the years as the vegetation goes through its successional changes over time, that the sounds that go with it are going to change. Another thing that particularly fascinates me would be change because of evolution. I didn't know this at all. I know that some people who do studies of it do know this, that bird songs change over time. Well, you would expect that. There are bird sound accents in different parts of the continent. The way I became aware of it is some of the Koyukon elders said to me, there's a problem with the robins. What's the problem? They don't talk right anymore. The robin in Koyukon tradition says, Dodo, silin, ulkoi, tziga, tilzut, tilzut, silni, silni. You know, it means down there my brother-in-law slurps up pike guts. I don't know where that comes from. I've never... But I'm serious when I say that I've talked to Koyukon elders within the last few years who are very upset about this. Something is wrong with the robins. So another thing that I think about in recording natural sounds is that 100 years from now, somebody can listen to these recordings and see what's happened and how these bird voices that we love so much have changed. So there's a big incentive for that. Now, in Western culture, our approach to the natural world centers around what we can see. We are incredibly visually focused. I don't know if that's true in all cultures in the world. I doubt it. This strong emphasis we have on the visual aspects of land and wildlife often leaves us oblivious to the sounds that surround us. They're either too subtle, or we're not paying attention, or they're overwhelmed by the human noise. So For me, recording sounds has completely, just personally, has completely refocused my attention. It's profoundly off-altered my entire sense about the natural world, or my senses. It's rebalanced my senses about the natural world. So coming in here earlier this evening, off in the distance, I could hear this very faint, distant robin, you know, singing to the accompaniment of distant traffic. And I thought, 5 years ago, there's no way I would have even, I would have heard the robin, but I wouldn't have heard the robin, if you know what I mean. So it's really changed. You begin, I think it allows you to constantly hear stuff that had escaped your attention before. Other things that have happened to me, I don't have a clip to play for it, and time is flying. I have always Swainson's thrushes around my house in the summertime, as probably many of you do. And to me, the Swainson's thrush is a sound that will almost just knock you over. You know, it's so glorious, so beautiful, so exquisite that it kind of makes you feel helpless to hear that sound. I began recording Swainson's thrushes in my backyard with a little handheld tape recorder years ago, many years ago. And to my astonishment, and again, people who study these things knew this long ago, but I didn't. So much better when you figure it out yourself. Every Swainson's thrush sounds different from every other one. And so I was able to know, for example, that the same Swainson's thrush, or else one of its offspring who had learned it, came back to my backyard for about 5 years in a row because of its song. It kind of left off one of the introductory phrases. And I have a recording, unfortunately, made with that little tape recorder of the most exquisite virtuoso Swainson's thrush with this long, trailing, ethereal, resonant end to each phrase of its song. Absolutely phenomenal. And recorded with just a terrible recorder. It's a shame. And I've gone back to that same place for years trying to find another one, but no such luck. So for me, anyway, and perhaps for you, if your attention has been drawn to this, the world becomes far richer than the one you knew before, saturated with this fresh new beauty, ringing and singing everywhere around you. In visual terms, I think of it as if I had been moving through some kind of a dusky haze and then slowly came out into clear daylight. And there it was. So now at last, I feel like I'm learning to hear what has always been there. Seeping up through the racket and the clamor of our world, you can hear things like the muttering of pintails, the incantations of winter wrens, the chipping of juncos, the ringing chatter of red squirrels, all sounds that I'm sure you know well. Through the hiss of wind, you might hear the distant rattle of a kingfisher, the whistled conversations of gray jays, the directionless hoot of blue grouse down in southeast Alaska. Sometimes I feel as if I'm being stopped in my tracks by that convoluted song of the ruby-crowned king that little thumb-sized bird singing in the top of the tree that says in the Koyukon language, chi 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 tahuzi tahuzi tahuzi. I didn't know what it was, and I went to the University of Alaska years ago to Bryna Kessel, the ornithologist, and I said, what bird says chi 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 tahuzi tahuzi? She said, ruby-crowned kinglet. All it was a silhouette in the top of a tree, and I couldn't see what it was. And things like the glinting cheeps of chickadees and the burblings of black turnstones, and of course the high proclamations of the ravens. There they are. You become aware that you're constantly moving through this endless and varied concert of living voices, braided through the sounds of wind in the spruce needles, the raindrops on the leaves, the waves along the lake shores or riversides, the snow sifting down through the branches, all these things, the pebbles ticking down banksides, all this kind of stuff, hearing it to the point of a constant, delighted, grateful distraction. It goes on day and night. It goes on summer and winter, city and countryside, and it's free. It's better than a garage sale. And all we have to do is start listening. I've also become much more conscious and frustrated by the fact that human sounds are literally everywhere. And I want to play for you, if I can find it, what has become in a perverse way. Oh, yeah, here it is. My gosh, that's a piece of luck. In a perverse way, and we'll need maybe a little bit of audio on this, a little volume. One of my favorite tracks, although at the time it made me feel like jumping off a bridge. I'd been following this loon around on a lake up in a very remote place called Takahula Lake in the Brooks Range. Been following this loon for about 5 days. I had learned that when the loons got separated, the pair of loons, if you could catch one of them asleep, when it woke up, it's going to call the other one. I found one of them sound asleep out in the lake against a massive wall of rock, the most perfect resonating chamber in the whole world. And this is a lonely place, and this is what happened. Is this happening? Can you guys hear it out there? So, now listen really closely. Maybe you'll hear me. There's the other one. I think I talked right there and you couldn't hear me. Maybe that's good. You hear the voice off that mountainside? I made a bad mistake here. Here's the last call. I made a bad mistake here because I turned off the recorder in total exasperation. I paused the recorder. This was a single bush plane, first one I'd seen in days. Not only did it fly through the sound, it flew right straight overhead, about 500 feet up, and the loon never stopped wailing. The best sequence of loon calls of that sort that I have ever heard, and I haven't gotten another one that good. But then I realized afterward, I thought, wait a minute, this is the perfect illustration of the problem. No matter how far out you are, we are still there. Of course, I had flown in there in a float plane a few days earlier. I mean, you can start pointing the finger, but it wants to go like this. So, always looking for that chance to get pure, unsullied, unimpeded natural sounds. But sounds like those, like the thrush, you know, singing out in the quietest, emptiest place you can possibly imagine. Like the hummingbird's wings as it feeds on a salmonberry flower. Sounds like that, or subtle sounds, like I was just in Gustavus recording blue grouse. They're the sorts of things that are overlooked by most people, but they're another treasure, absolute treasure of Alaska's wildness. In most of Alaska today, we can still lavish ourselves in sounds that were heard by ancient ancestral people who crossed the Bering Land Bridge to come here and settle this continent. We can hear the same sounds today that were heard by the first earliest European explorers and settlers to come here. Captain Cook, what was it, 1778, coming up here, turning an arm. At times, it's easy enough to imagine that we are hearing the sounds from the original time of creation itself. It's an incredible privilege we have to live in such a world as this, when almost everywhere else people are immersed in a constant clatter of urban sounds and an industrial roar. I was reading, actually just this morning, a newspaper article about the ongoing and burgeoning resurfacing debates over the future of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and it set me to thinking. And I spent part of this afternoon thrashing around about that in my mind. And I got to wondering, what is Alaska's most abundant, most sustainable, most valuable resource over the long haul? Over the really long haul, what is it? Well, in this crowd, maybe that's a no-brainer. Is it oil? Is it fisheries? Is it hydropower? Is it timber? Is it minerals? Well, of course, We all had better acknowledge that they're important to every one of us, those things, and that we all use them before we start, again, pointing that finger at others. Because it's like thinking about the tragic new oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Who will pay for it? The government? The oil companies? Uh-uh. Every one of us. And who should pay for it? Every one of us. It's no use pointing the finger at the government or the corporations. That's not where the finger ought to point. And we are all indebted for those things that we use and to the people who provide them for us. So we need to be thoughtful. In any case, but I also think Alaska has another kind of resource that's measured in different ways. It may be that we measure it by the 586,000 square miles of land, one-fifth the size of the continental U.S. It may be the over 6,000 miles of coastline, more, as you know, than all the lower 48 states combined. It may be the 3 million lakes. It may be the 3,000 rivers, including the Yukon, the longest river in North America. It might be the, I don't know who's counting, the U.S. Geological Survey says 100,000 glaciers. Two of them, as we know, larger than Delaware. It may be 17 of the 20 highest peaks in the United States, including, of course, Denali, 20,230 feet. It may be almost a million caribou. It might be at least 100,000 moose, one of whom might be looking in the... Oh, no. Not a moose at the moment, but could be in a while. It may be the 30,000 grizzly bears or the 100,000 black bears. Grizzly bears, 98% of the total U.S. population, a rather tragic figure because we once had a population maybe 50 to 100,000 grizzlies down there. It may be muskox and mountain sheep, polar bears and wolverines, humpback whales and bald eagles, about half the world's population of those in Alaska. It may be the fact that we live in one of the world's greatest breeding grounds for birds, birds that come from all the continents, South America, Asia, the Pacific Islands, Africa, Australia, even from the Antarctic. It may be the 100 million or so nesting seabirds, countless millions of ducks and geese and swans and shorebirds. It might be the fact that Alaska is North America's songbird factory, a source of the birds that bring so much beauty to the backyards throughout the rest of the country for the other part of the year when they're not here reproducing and raising their young. And where else on earth do we find anything equal to the combined, gloriously accumulated glory of beauty of Alaska, epitomized by the peaks of Denali National Park, the caribou of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, the volcanic islands of the Aleutians National Wildlife Refuge, the brown bears of Katmai National Park, the temperate rainforests of the Tongass and Chugach National Forests, the glaciers of Kenai Fjords National Park, the evolving landscapes of Glacier Bay National Park, the boreal vastness of Yukon Charley National Park, and the remote splendor of Gates of the Arctic National Park, to mention just a few of the places. And I pick the protected public wildlands on purpose because they belong to all of us. And it's all of our responsibility to remember that. The value of wildness and beauty on such a scale as we have in Alaska is impossible, as you know, to calculate. It's probably also the most rapidly diminishing resource on Earth. Can we assure in some way that this permanent, self-sustaining, and theoretically inexhaustible resource continues? We need to recognize its value. We need to commit ourselves, I think, to make sure that it doesn't dwindle and disappear. The scarcer that this heritage of wildness becomes elsewhere, the more people will come here for the experience and enlightenment that wildness offers. At the same time, we Alaskans can continue to draw our sustenance from these places. We can perpetuate cultural traditions within them, and into them we can go to elevate our souls and to nurture our spirits. When I hear the caroling choruses of wild voices that surround us in Alaska, I dream of kids like the ones that are here tonight and their kids and their kids after them, centuries from now, hearing exactly these same sounds. In a world that I hope and dream has grown wiser because it has learned to listen. Thanks so much for being here.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Richard Nelson, host and producer of Encounters at Raven Radio in Sitka, Alaska. He met with listeners and talked about Encounters Radio and recording in the wild at a public event hosted by KSKA and the Bureau of Land Management. His talk entitled Listening to Alaska was recorded at the Campbell Creek Science Center in Anchorage on Friday, May 14th, 2010. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.